We've been working our way through Galatians 1, and all of us are aware that the line of argument that Paul is making is that his gospel is not human. It didn't come from a man to him. It didn't have a human instrumentality through any source to him of a human way. I mean, that was his thesis statement in verses 11, 12. And then he began to move through and argue that he couldn't possibly have gotten the gospel at the depth of understanding that he was able to preach in Damascus from any human source because he hadn't been around any humans who could have done it for him. As soon as he recovered from the little episode with his confrontation on the road to Damascus, he left, went to Arabia. And how long he was there, we don't know. But he came back to Damascus when he came back. And the book of Acts says that he preached Jesus in the synagogues, and he was so powerful in his argumentation that the Jews there finally decided that they had to kill him. I mean, if you can't beat him with your argument, then the only thing to do to shut him up is to kill him. So they wanted to do that, but he escaped going over the wall. And it wasn't until 3 years after his conversion, according to verse 18, that he did go up to Jerusalem to be acquainted with Peter. He stayed with him 15 days. He didn't see any of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother. Now, in what I'm writing to you, I assure you before God, I'm not lying. Now, the issue here is that it was 3 years after his Damascus Road experience that he actually did go to Jerusalem. But when he got there, according to the book of Acts, nobody had anything to do with him except Barnabas. And Barnabas, it says, took him in and persuaded those that were willing to be persuaded that Paul was legit. But according to this, the only ones that he actually had any exposure to at all were Peter and James, the Lord's brother. And yet, in a 15-day span, even a genius can't come up with the depth of content in 15 days. That's why Dallas Seminary requires you to go for 4 years. Of course, they're trying, you know, they're playing catch up because you have to learn Hebrew and Greek and start from scratch. But the point being, everybody would recognize that 15 days is not enough time to get the depth of understanding that he manifested in his proclamation. When he preached and argued his case, proving that Jesus was the Christ, they could not refute him. His biblical arguments and the historical realities were coming together in such a way that, you know, they got fed up with him. And it got dangerous in Jerusalem too, so he had to leave within a couple of weeks. So, verses 18 and 19 are not... I didn't work much with the details there because we already worked with the Jerusalem thing as a place where you'd expect to get the truth. And he did go up there 3 years after he'd been preaching or after his conversion. The thing that caught my attention, and this is going to be a shock to all of y'all because we're going to move 18, 19, and 20. We're going to real quickly, and I know that'll be a real whiplash for you, but... The thing that got my attention was verse 20. Now, in what I'm writing to you, I assure you before God that I'm not lying. That sounds a little like we need to do some thinking about it. Because we have looked at in depth at Paul's argument. The problem with the statement in verse 20 is that it almost seems like it just jerks the rug out from everything that he said so far. It's obvious from the statement, before God, I'm not lying, it's obvious he wants them to believe him, but good grief. What that really says is, you can dismiss everything he said so far by just saying, well, you're lying. And his response is, before God, I'm not lying. Well, yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Where does that go? I mean, how do you have any confidence that... He's not lying just because he says he's not. I mean, this is the problem to me. So I began to look at the issue of his statement. I assure you before God, in the things that I'm writing to you, that I am not lying. Because that statement in and of itself has no weight in the sense that even a liar is going to say, I'm not lying. I mean, the statement, I'm not lying, the most you can assign to it in terms of its impact is he wants you to believe him. I mean, I hear people all the time says, well, to be, you know, I want to be honest with you. And I said, well, have you always been, or just is this one time or what? But that's the kind of thing that happens when somebody says, I assure you, I am not lying. Before God, I'm not lying. Well, that would carry a lot of weight if people were typically truthful. And bringing God into the thing would even add a little more weight if people were typically God-fearing. But Paul's own theology is every man's a liar, and most people don't fear God. So it's a problem to inject this at this level of his argument, because it introduces some things that I want us to do some thinking about. Before we do, though, I want to point out a couple of other times when Paul introduced this issue of not lying. He does this. This reference in Galatians is one of four in the New Testament. The other three are in interesting places. In Romans chapter 9, he's going to, and I've mentioned this one before, so you're familiar with it, but he's going to tell them that he would be willing to go to hell for his kinsmen according to the flesh. But he knows that that's such a radical statement that, I mean, it's either a lie or hyperbole, or it's the truth. And he knows that that's the way people are going to look at it. When you claim that you would be willing to go to hell for a bunch of people who've been persecuting you and harassing you, and even if they were people that really liked you, the scenario of going into eternal accursedness is so overwhelming that for anybody to say, I'd be willing to do that and not be just putting on the dog, most people think, I don't know if I love anybody that much. When you, it comes right down to it. Well, Paul knows that, so in verse 1 of chapter 9, he says, in three ways, he says, I'm telling you the truth. He says, I'm telling you the truth of Christ. I'm not lying. My conscience is bearing me witness in the Holy Spirit. Okay? That's like saying, look, I'm really not lying to you. But the stacking up of those three ways of saying it, it emphasizes that Paul wants the Romans to believe him. Whether they're going to believe him or not is another issue, but it's obvious that he wants them to. So Paul did, in his writings, on occasions, say things like, I assure you, I'm not lying. But like I've already said, that only carries weight if you know the person well enough to say, well, okay, I believe you. But how long was he in Galatia? How long did they get to have time to get to know him in any kind of real way? I mean, in the book of Acts, when he preached in those cities in Galatia, and then went back through establishing elders, there isn't any indication that he was in any of those towns for more than just weeks. Oh, how many people do you know that you've known for weeks that you would believe them if they said, I'm not lying, if they told you something that was obviously, you know, just almost unbelievable? That's the problem that we're dealing with. And it's no small thing, because Paul is writing the book of Galatians trying to get the Galatians to believe what he's writing. So it's a big issue. It has to do with whether we can trust or not. In 2 Corinthians 11, Paul makes another statement about this truth-telling business. He says in 2 Corinthians 11:31. Well, let's back up. Starting in verses 5, starting in verse 23, he starts comparing himself to these people that are giving the Corinthians a bad time, and he begins to boast about all the stuff that he's suffered in comparison with them, because he's trying to get the Corinthians to understand, look, you have accepted the word of these people, but they have not paid nearly the price I have paid, so why are you giving them more credit than me? I mean, that's his argument, and he's trying to get them to trust what he's saying. So he goes through this whole thing, and then he says in verse 30, if I have to boast, I'll boast of what pertains to my weakness. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus, he who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. All right? Now, what's he trying to say? Well, he's trying to say that if I have to boast, I'm going to boast about the things that make me impotent, that make me incapable. Because in a very real sense, he taught in another place where he was weak, God was strong. Where he was strong, God was weak in a relative sense. So, but this issue of boasting in your weakness is so contrary to what most people do. Nobody goes around bragging about what they can't do. All their flaws and weaknesses. So when he says that, he introduces a level of unbelief. And so he just says, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, he who is blessed forever knows I'm not lying. And again, he's trying to get them to believing. The oddest reference in the New Testament, as far as I'm concerned, is 2 Timothy. If you look over at 2 Timothy chapter 2, Paul makes a comment in verse 7, which I consider, as I said, to be the oddest comment perhaps in Paul's writing. 1 Timothy 2:7. He says, he's talking about the gospel and Christ, and he said he was appointed a preacher and apostle in verse 7. And then he makes this little statement, I'm telling the truth, I'm not lying. Now, who did he say that to? Yeah, Timothy. And how long had he been working with Timothy? And, you know, when you look at the chronology of Paul's life, 1 Timothy was written, two or three years before he died. So he's had years of exposure to Timothy. Timothy was his understudy for a long, long time. If there was anybody on the earth that knew Paul very well, it would have been guys like Barnabas and Silas and Timothy and these guys that spent all these years with him. And so he says to Timothy, I'm not lying. That just, well, good grief. Why would he have to say that to Timothy? And the point being, again, it's obvious that he is reinforcing or trying to reinforce the integrity of his words. So, in a sense, Paul has a habit in the New Testament of claiming that he's not lying. The problem is, as we've already pointed out, it highlights the possibility that he is lying. I mean, if you're going to deny that you're lying, obviously you're assuming that somebody's going to think you are. And the very denial raises that possibility. Is Paul just spinning the yarn here in Galatians chapter 1? Should the Galatians be a little leery? Should they risk their understanding of what's true on the basis of a person who might be telling them a lie? And since, on the other hand, not only does it highlight this possibility, but it brings up this most vexing problem. Don't most liars claim they're not lying? And what good is such a claim in any case? I mean, just because I tell you I'm not lying doesn't mean I'm not lying. And for me to tell you that doesn't help anything. I mean, it obviously means I want you to believe me, but you don't know why I want you to believe me. And I may have all kinds of ulterior reasons. I mean, Paul said of his opponents in this letter, at the end of the letter in chapter 6, that they were seeking to make a good show in the flesh and wanted to escape persecution for the cross's sake. And that was the reason they were teaching these people this false doctrine. Well, if you'd have asked them if they were lying, they'd say, no, I'm not lying. And the question is, well, why did they want the Galatians to believe them instead of Paul? Well, Paul says, if he's right, and under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, we have to assume that he is, that they were investing in a method of living that would make a fair show in the flesh and keep them from being persecuted. So, given that as their motivation, yeah, they'd say I'm not lying. But they were. So when Paul says, I'm not lying, you have to wonder, okay, what if he is? What's he going to gain by this? What's going on here? Why would he insert this claim into his argument at this point? What of the things that I'm writing to you would most likely create the accusation that he's lying? I don't believe that they would have gone back to verses 13 through 14, where he argues that his message should be given some strong consideration because it changes his life. They wouldn't argue that. I mean, they would accuse Paul of having formerly been a Pharisee of the Pharisees, and that he was a traitor and a turncoat and an apostate and somebody who'd turned from the truth into this heresy. They would have admitted that his life changed radically. So they wouldn't have said, well, you're lying when you claim that your life has changed. They wouldn't have said that. So the real issue is the next stage of his argument, that he was able to preach the gospel in a significant level of depth so that he could answer and refute all the arguments against his theology without ever having been exposed to anybody who could have given him that kind of depth of understanding. That's his claim. And that's where they're going to accuse him of lying. They're going to say, they're going to use the same kind of argument that's used today in extra-biblical realm where people say, well, you know, there was a fish that swallowed Jonah and he survived 3 days and then it belched him up on the... And they'll say, that could not possibly have happened. That's a fable. That's the argument. What Paul is claiming is impossible. You can't preach at the level of his understanding without having been taught it. It's not possible. So he's lying. That's the kind of false argument that happens all the time in relation to biblical revelation. The Bible claims that this miraculous fact happened, and men say that couldn't possibly have happened, so it didn't. So they're lying. And you say, well, how do you know it can't possibly happen? Well, it's never happened. Nobody's ever seen that happen. Well, there were several thousand people that saw it happen. Yeah, but that's a lie. That's a record. It didn't happen. On what basis? Well, it couldn't have. Well, it could have if God is omnipotent. And if Jesus was God in the flesh, and if the Father was willing to empower by the Spirit the miracles that he did, it is possible if you assume those assumptions. You can't just dismiss it and say, can't happen. Just because you have never seen it happen doesn't mean it can't happen. So, the argument's false, but that's what they would have said. They would have just said, well, it's just not possible for Paul to have this level of argumentative skill and never have been exposed to Jesus' apostles where he'd have got all this trash. That's what they would have said. You're lying. But what is the issue in his argument up to this point in terms of, I can explain the message as clearly as anybody that you can talk to about it, and I never was exposed to any of them. I got this from some other source. His claim is he got it by revelation from Jesus himself. Okay, what's the potency of that argument? Well, if it's a true argument, if in fact he is not lying, then it makes the message of the gospel inescapably true. You can't get around it because you can't explain away a phenomena like that or a set of phenomena like that where he is able to explain the gospel as well as Peter can, having never talked to Peter or, you know, any other human being. So, in a very real sense, this is exactly the same apologetic that Isaiah used. Isaiah's apologetic, in which his defense of the identity of Yahweh as the God of Israel, was rooted in basically one argument that shows up 3 or 4 times in the book of Isaiah. And that argument, one of the forms is Isaiah 40, verses 5 through 10. But that apologetic is this. Isaiah knew that anybody can claim to be worshiping the true God. Anybody can. I mean, the worshippers of Allah can say Allah is the true God. The Hindus can claim that whatever God they have is the true God. Every religion claims that their God is the true God. Isaiah knew that there were all these competitors for God in the mind of the man. So in his writing, he recognized that you have to have something that says, this is the true God, and all of the rest of them are off. They're not the true God. And Isaiah's argument was this: you'll know when you're dealing with the true God, when he speaks in history, in real words, at the beginning, and tells you things that are going to happen down the road, even at the end, and those words come to pass in history exactly as they were uttered when the time comes. In other words, fulfilled prophecy is the apologetic of the book of Isaiah. And the reasoning is thus. In a chooser-producer world where cause and effect is the ruling principle, where you have millions of people making choices and taking actions, it would require omniscience to be able to say 600 years from now this is going to happen, or this will happen at this particular juncture in the development of humanity, or any other kind of prophecy. Because when you have so many people making choices and taking actions in a cause and effect universe, ain't nobody going to be able to tell you how things are going to work out down the line unless they're omniscient or connected to omniscience by being a representative, a mouthpiece for the omniscient one. So in Isaiah, he constantly says, who is a God like I am who can tell you from the beginning what's going to be at the end? He said, all your competitors, these stumps that you go out in the woods and cut out of these trees and you form it into an idol and you set it up and you bow down to it, it can't talk. It can't even hear you. You take half of that tree and make a fire out of it, and the other half you make a thing out of it and you call it your God. But it can't even talk or hear, and it certainly can't tell you what's going to happen down the road. But my God can. And the prophecy, there have been sufficiently short-term prophecies as well as long-term ones. There have been a sufficient number of short-term prophecies that have happened exactly the way that they were predicted to happen, so that there was no doubt that a God who could tell you what was going to happen was the true God. And that is an unassailable, irrefutable argument. I mean, you have to take your brains out and just dismiss them to argue that anybody could tell the future who doesn't have the omniscience necessary to do that. So Isaiah set this scenario up. Well, Paul is basically copying that in this statement about the truthfulness of his message. If you can get around his argument that he could preach this stuff without ever being taught, if you can get around that, fine. But if you can't get around it, it's true. Because it's impossible. It's impossible for Paul to be able to preach at the level of understanding that he had without ever being taught it by a man, unless he was taught it by somebody else, other than a man. And his claim is, I was, by Jesus. Okay, well, that's either true or it's not true. But his ability says it's true. And if you don't believe him, you're going to have to get around it somehow. Well, you can't get around it except by saying, well, you're a liar. That's what he was anticipating in verse 20. I'm not lying. So, on the one hand, the potency of his argument is that it sets up an inescapable conclusion that you can't get around. The second issue is, if it's really true that he could preach without being taught by men, it leaves every human being on the planet without any true option beyond yielding to the message. I mean, if it's true, capital T, then nobody can legitimately dismiss it. The only option that anybody has, if this is the very word of the omniscient God who created heavens and earth, if he means what he said, and if we've understood what his meaning is, there is no legitimate option except to yield to it. Every other option is unacceptable. That's why Paul said even in Romans 1, never without excuse. Well, that's where the bind comes in. Because ever since Genesis 3, men don't want such a thing as final truth, because it disallows any legitimacy to their false pursuits. They want to do things that the God of the Scripture says, don't do that. They don't want to do things that He says, do that. And because they don't like that final truth thing, where they're condemned if they don't do or do, depending on which way you're looking at it, that just leaves them in a rage. So that's where the bind comes. We, since the fall, have never liked being told, this is your only option. We want to be free to do as we please. Well, why? Why is it that there is something in humanity from Genesis 3 on that says, don't tell me what I have to do? What is it? Well, I believe that it's a corruption at the roots. The things that men value and the things that they consider legitimate means to accomplishing the valuable thing, both of those are corrupt. Men value things that are not valuable, and for that reason, they chase them with illegitimate methods. So they love what's not valuable and they believe what's not true. And they do this because of the corruption that set in way back. People don't want to be told that the things that they like the most are just trash. They're just junk. They're just not valuable at all. You shouldn't be even wasting your time chasing that, because it's such a waste of everything. They don't want to hear it, especially if they really like it. So that's the problem. And that's where he's dealing with the Galatian problem in this verse with this statement. I'm not lying. Because if he's not, then, okay, the rest of the book, every word in it's true. If he's not lying, every jot, every tittle, every statement, properly understood, should be responded to with, okay, if that's true, this is where I'm going to live. If that's true, this is the choice I'm going to make. If that's true, this is the bent my life's going to take. If that's true, then all of this other stuff that I have been counting on being true, I will dismiss it because it's not true, if that's true. Well, that puts men in a terrible bind because, like I said, we don't really want that. So it makes the issue of relating to the grace of God man's only true option, but it's a scary one. Relating to God as a gracious God is very scary. And there are several reasons for it. Number one, you can't ever count on what's going to happen, other than statements. I mean, if God has said something's going to happen, it's going to happen. But there is so much of life that is not actually covered by a direct statement, and therefore, you can't be sure. Why not? Why can't we be sure if God is acting in grace? Because there are no rules. Right. If God was being just, you could tell what He's going to do. Because the law's written, and you say, okay, this law says this, and if you don't do it, then this will be the consequence. They didn't do it. This is going to happen to them. But as soon as you introduce grace into the mix, you can't say what's going to happen. They did this, and this should have happened if it was just, but it's not just. It's gracious, so it didn't happen. And all of a sudden and you know where the rub really gets next to us? Is when we realize that the God of grace doesn't have to be gracious to us. That's where all our security goes. If we can't make Him be gracious, then why would He be? That's the problem most men have. And that's the reason why most people are legalists. They want some kind of rule that says, if I do this, then God will have to do what I insist that He has to do for me. That's the idea of trying to get a lever on God, to force the hand. But if He's gracious, then you can't force it. And that puts men in a very difficult state of insecurity. And that makes the issue of, okay, if God is committed to operating graciously, that's the book of Galatians, if He's really committed to being gracious, which means you can't force Him, then how in the world do you ever get comfortable with the fact that He's a gracious God? And the answer is, because you've got to stop being so loving of yourself and start loving like He does, but that means that He is a God of love. If you can't trust a God of grace, you can trust a God of love. I mean, if grace means He's able to do whatever, He's not bound by the rules. He doesn't have to be just. He already was just. I mean, Christ released God from any necessity to be just. Therefore, He can be gracious or not. It's up to Him. Well, you can't get a lot of security out of that, but you can if you fall back to the position of, well, love. If God is not a God of love, then being a God of grace is no big plus. Because that means I'm still out in the cold. But if He's a God of love and a God of grace, then I at least have something to fall back on to give me some sense that I can benefit from relating to Him as a gracious God, because He's a loving one, if I'm willing to relate to Him. And that's Paul's entire argument in the book of Galatians. If you are willing to believe what He says, you can relate to Him. He will accept you on the basis of the fact that you trust Him, that you believe what He says. If you'll believe Him, He won't harbor all these ill will attitudes toward you for all the bad stuff you did before you trusted Him. He won't do that, because He says, if you'll trust Me, I'll do what I've said. So I will relate to you if you will just trust Me. So that's where the insecurity is resolved. It settles into this love thing, but as Kelly said, you got to stop loving yourself, because that's a false love, in order to be able to turn loose of the whole issue of, well, what's going to happen to me? Well, if God's a God of love and you want to love like He does, it doesn't matter what's going to happen to you. Bottom line. Now, in the scriptures, Jesus went out of His way to make sure that we understood that if we would love like God loved, He would come back and not let that burn us. He's the one that said that. If we're willing to die to ourselves, if we're willing to let whatever's going to happen to us without our complaint, if we're willing to do that, God will come back around and make sure that that doesn't burn us. He will guarantee that the outcome will be good for us. I mean, that's Romans 8:28. So, that raises this question in verse 20 of Galatians 1. How does Paul's claim that he's not lying further his argument? How does it further his argument in chapter 1 that his gospel's true? It's not from men. Well, I think it goes without saying that all men want to be believed in the things they declare to be true. Everybody wants to be believed. Even liars want to be believed. It hurts the human pride to not be trusted. And even when people have consistently proven you can't trust them, they still want you to trust them. I mean, I don't know how many kids get all teary-eyed and all frustrated. Mom, you bad, you just don't trust me. And they've done all of this stuff that you couldn't trust, because they have established that they're not trustworthy, but they still want to be trusted. Well, Paul's statement, I assure you, before God, that I'm not lying, is just an expression in one sense of wanting to be believed. But it also goes without saying, I think, that most men cannot be believed when somebody says, I'm going to tell you the truth. This is a God-honest truth. I, before God, I'm not lying. When they start in on that, you have to just back up and say, wait a minute, what are they trying to pull wool over my eyes about? What is it they want me to buy? That goes without saying, because that's the nature of humanity. But it's also an established fact that because even liars will claim to be telling the truth, that we have to decide what was the point of Paul's claim here. If he was telling the truth, fine. If he wasn't, then the claim doesn't make... When you're lying and you say, I'm telling you the truth, people are just susceptible to being deceived by your claim, but it's not true. So, what's the bottom line here? Well, is Paul really admitting that everything that he's written up to this point can be destroyed by the simple accusation while he's lying? Is that what he's admitting when he says, now, And what I'm writing to you, I assure you before God, I'm not lying. Is he admitting that everything can be destroyed by the accusation that he's lying? Well, is it? Can it be? Well, sure, if the people believe it. Everything Paul has written will be reduced to nothing if the accusation that he's lying is believed by the people that he's writing to. If you believe he's lying, you're not going to trust anything he says. So he is, in a sense, admitting that if you believe I'm lying here, then all the rest of what I'm trying to do is shot. So I'm assuring you before God that I'm not lying. But how does that further his argument? Why does he deny the accusation that he's lying? Well, two or three things. Number one, he acknowledges that that will be one of his opponents, one of his adversaries or opposition's tactics. They'll accuse him of lying. Yeah, he's going to accuse them of lying, too. But it's equally true that denying that you're lying doesn't help a lot. So when he denies it, what's the point? Well, he's simply pointing out that whether you believe what I say is going to make a difference, a crucial difference. In other words, if you believe I'm lying to you, that faith that I'm a liar is going to have an impact on your life. The words that I write to you will not have a good effect on you because you won't trust them. So he's admitting that. And he wants them to have to wrestle with that. Am I willing to say that Paul is a liar so that I don't have to believe anything he says? Or is he really telling me the truth? And what will be the consequences for me, depending on which way I go? Paul says, well, you're going to have to decide whether you believe me or not. But also, the denial raises the bar on the entire accusation, denial debate. Because what has he been arguing? He's been arguing on the basis of historical examination. In other words, he's been making historically validatable statement. I left Damascus and went into Arabia. I didn't talk to anybody that could have explained the gospel to me like those guys in Jerusalem. When I came back from Arabia, I came back to Damascus. When I was in Damascus, I was preaching the gospel. 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem and I spent 15 days with Peter and I saw James, the Lord's brother. But the rest of them, they wouldn't have anything to do with me. I didn't see them. 15 days. These are verifiable historical claims. But for whom? How many of the Galatians have the resources, motivation, or opportunity to check these historical facts out? Almost none. So even if you commission somebody, well, go do the historical research for us and come back and tell us what you found, you're still caught with the fact that what he tells you he found, he could be lying. You see the problem? Everybody could be lying. So when he raises the bar to the issue of historical examination, he in effect is doing what Jesus did in John chapter 3 verse 12 when he was talking to Nicodemus about the new birth. Jesus asked him this question. If I tell you earthly things and you don't believe me, how will you believe me if I tell you heavenly things? And his argument is thus. If you don't believe what you can go check and verify, when I tell you something that you can go check and verify, if you don't believe me when you are exposed to stuff that is verifiably true in history, then how am I going to take you to the next level where I'm going to be telling you stuff that you cannot go check and verify? You're just going to have to trust me. Paul, in a sense, is doing this here because there is a difficulty of historical examination, but it's put out there. If you're going to accuse me of lying, you have to prove that my claims are not true. In other words, you're going to have to come up with some witnesses to say, well, I saw Paul huddled up with Peter and John and James and Andrew and all those guys for, 4 years of seminary. They're going to have to come up with something more than, well, it just can't be true, so he's a liar. That's just a non-persuasive argument. That's the thing that Satan used in Genesis 3. You will not die. Based on what? Well, because I said it. You won't die. Well, but you're saying he lied, and you're expecting me to believe you. Why should I believe you? I have no track record with you. I have quite a bit of a track record with him. He told me I would die. He's the one who's been feeding me and giving me more water than I can drink and letting me eat. And you know, he's the one who's been the source of all of the good in my life up to this point. What have you done? Nothing. And you expect me to believe you? Yeah. Well, see, that's the kind of thing that Paul is introducing here. He is actually forcing the issue. If you're going to accuse me of lying, you're going to have to prove it. Because my historical claims are these, and they can be verified. Just because you don't want to verify them doesn't mean that you don't have the responsibility to. If you're going to accuse me of lying, you're going to have to prove that I'm a liar. And that's what he's done. He's pushed that. But what's the bottom line going to be? And that is, what happens to you if you believe what he wrote? Or what happens to you if you don't believe what he wrote? That's going to be the bottom line. In other words, Paul's message is going to be the bottom line. What is the message that is life transforming for the better compared to the other message? When you take the message of grace and the message of the law, what is the outworking of those two messages really believed? Even if Paul's lying when he preaches this truth, if the truth is true, then it will do whatever it claims. And if it's a lie, it'll just end up being a vacuous bunch of philosophy. So Paul says, this message transformed my life for the better. I was hateful. I was arrogant. I was social climber. I didn't like anybody but myself, etc., etc., etc. And when I believed this message, it suddenly flipped my whole life over, so that now I'm not interested in being a glory hound, and I really don't care about physical, material prosperity and pleasure and all that. My goal is to make sure people understand God in the same way that I have come to understand, so that their lives will be improved. Okay, that's his message. What's the legalist's message? If you will keep all of the rules that God has given, your life will be very good. And if you violate them, you will suffer the justice that's due you for your violation. Well, there are two problems there. Number one, Paul said, not even those who preach the law can keep it. So that's the problem. If your message has this inherent problem with it, your life will be good if you can do all these things. Well, what if I can't do all these things? Well, then your life's going to be hell. Tough. Well, the problem is nobody could keep the law. So the message of the law was inherently destructive when it was used as a method of salvation. It would destroy you. It would not save you. So there was that problem. Plus, what was the outcome of really being committed to this message? All you have to do is look at Paul. He was one of the most committed in his generation. Well, what was he like? He was a murderous, social climbing, clawing for the top, egocentric maniac. Okay, is that the kind of life you want? So really, bottom line, this statement in verse 20, I assure you before God, I am not lying in the things that I'm writing to you. It's just pushing the issue, because he knows he's going to be accused of lying. And he's basically forcing them to deal with the bottom line. And the bottom line is going to be the message itself. What are the consequences of my message? What have been for 1,500 years the consequences of this message that I have rejected, having been in it for 30-something years? So I think it's I don't think that his statement, I'm not lying, means he's not lying. I mean, under the inspiration of the Spirit, obviously it meant that. But I mean, just because somebody tells you they're not lying doesn't mean they're not. But it does force you to start dealing with, okay, what have they said that I want to accuse them of lying about? What is it about the message that they're teaching that is going to destroy me if I believe it? That's the real question. Okay?